Hi, my name is Robert Lamb. I am the deputy director and a senior fellow here at CSIS and deputy director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project. And I have been asked to give some introductory remarks before we turn it over to Ashley and our speakers. I worked at the Department of Defense for about 2 years. It was a very exciting time. You could almost feel the paradigm shifting under your feet. I actually don't like the term paradigm, but I worked at the Defense Department for a while, so you have to use these things. I'm an old school, way back long ago, a human rights activist from many years ago, and you know, in typical liberal undergrad form, was very concerned about U.S. support to regimes that were violating human rights and military training foreign militaries that committed human rights violations, and you know, this is a big concern. Sort of typical of the peace community in the 80s, and later on in graduate school, I took kind of a two-track approach. I studied what were then still called emerging threats, which had largely emerged by that point, but they were still emerging, and they're still considered emerging security threats, but I'm pretty sure they're fully formed by now. And then the other track was development ethics. And so it was interesting to be at the strategy office at the Department of Defense during a period when things weren't going particularly well in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is 2006, 2007, and people were really open to new ideas, including the possibility that maybe protecting populations and achieving our national security objectives might not necessarily be in principle in conflict. And so it was interesting to watch. There were all these reviews of stability operations doctrine. There was sort of an emerging concept called irregular warfare. I was working on a project that was horribly named called Ungoverned Areas, looking at threats that emerged from safe havens around the world. And of course, the rock star effort was the new counterinsurgency doctrine that ultimately came to recognize that, oh, right, if you want to win in these sorts of wars, you actually have to have the population on your side. And so maybe that involves protecting them and respecting them and helping them have reasonably decent lives. And so this was very exciting. Now, in parallel, in the development community, there was a long-term trend away from measuring development success based on macroeconomic indicators and more towards a focus of looking at, well, how do what do people actually have? And then from there, it's like, well, it's not really what do people have, it's what can they actually do with what they have. Do they have the capability of living the sorts of lives that they want to live? And then somewhere along the way, people recognize that well, oftentimes conflict and security problems really make it difficult for people to do the sorts of things that they want to do. And so this human development paradigm sort of merged with the freedom of fear and responsibility to protect strains as well. And this concept of human security emerged. Now, it didn't emerge full formed in 2005, although that was the big splash, the Human Security Commission. There were lots of antecedents before that, but 2005 was sort of the big splash in the world. And so it was interesting to work at the Department of Defense for a couple of years when a lot of the same impulse that was driving the human security work is people want to be safe, they want to have decent lives. Why can't we help that? That impulse was driving the people who did work on human security. That impulse was recognized as important in the security world, in the more traditional counterinsurgency world. And they both face similar challenges. One thing that we're seeing as the counterinsurgency doctrine is actually being implemented today in place, especially in Afghanistan, is that as currently conceived, counterinsurgency can be an extraordinarily expensive and intensive effort. Now, I don't think that in principle it needs to be, but the way it's currently being practiced, it really is extremely expensive. And how do you protect populations in places like Kandahar or in small villages in the middle of nowhere that don't have, there's no jobs, there's no there's very little access to formal or often even informal decision-making procedures. Locally, people are poor, people are sick, there's not much education. Where do you even begin? And in a lot of ways in Afghanistan, it's just, let's just throw all we've got at it and see what sticks. There are probably better ways. One of the criticisms of the human security approach has been, well, all bad things go together and all good things go together, and to fix the problem, you have to fix everything at once. I don't think that's true in principle, but it is a challenge that, you know, how do you actually, when you actually get out into a place where you want to protect human security and let this emerge, how do you prioritize your efforts in a world when there's not always enough personnel to do the work, there's not always enough money coming from foreign capitals to do the work? How do you actually do this? But I think the overall framework is smart and important, and finding ways to overcome the various conceptual and practical challenges to implementing it, I think is extremely important. So I'm really glad to have our speakers here today. I'm glad to see this book being published. And to hear that it's getting to a wider and wider audience, this is, I think, is good news. So I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say and to the Q&A.
Thanks. Thanks, Bob, for that introduction. Like PCR, CSIS's new program, the Project on Prosperity and Development, also shares an interest with several of the themes of the book, which, if I may add to Bob's introduction, includes the fact that security in the 21st century is complex and includes a broad array of so-called soft categories. 20th century handling of 21st century problems can actually make the problem worse, and the current U.S. approach to quelling conflict isn't working and is costing a lot of money. A human security approach is a comprehensive one that helps to create a space for development. And what the Project on Prosperity and Development is interested in as it relates to this book is how that approach can help to enable economic development, the kind that generates real economic growth. And what we're interested in is how that can be done in areas where we have troops on the ground and just across the developing world in general. The way the current efforts are structured, while not without patches of success, are essentially counterproductive to generating effective economic development. And yet there's widespread recognition here in Washington and out in the field that generating jobs and reviving or creating an economy that exists outside the gray and war economies are essential to the mission at hand. This disconnect and more are addressed in The Ultimate Weapon. Okay, right. Without further delay, I'd like to introduce the authors. Detailed bios of each can be found in your program, but I'm going to take this opportunity to say a few words about each. I first met Lieutenant Colonel Shannon Beebe this past summer when he and Mary were doing a kind of soft rollout for their book. In listening to his presentation, it occurred to me that his on-the-ground experience as a member of the U.S. military gave him a perspective that others in the military could relate to. He's recently back from Angola, where he served as assistant army attaché to the U.S. mission there, and is actually recognized as one of the foremost authorities on Africa inside the Pentagon, and now, I suspect, after this book, outside of it as well. Now, no disrespect to Shannon, but I take particular pleasure in introducing your co-author, Mary Caldor. Mary is the director of the Center for Global Governance at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where she is also a professor. I first met Mary in the summer of 2005 when I was taking your Global Civil Society course. I was actually on my way to class one day and running late, which for those of you who know me is entirely out of character for me. When the July 7 bombings occurred across central London. I later went on to complete a master's degree there at the LSE and took additional courses with Mary. But that summer and the lessons that were learned from that summer seemed to leap out of the pages and books from the courses that we were taking and into our reality. Some of those same anecdotes and arguments that occur from that experience and her field experience across the Balkans, Iraq, Afghanistan, and more are weaved into the book and provide a nice marriage between European academia, Mary's field experience, and that of Shannon's with the U.S. military. With that, I'll turn the floor over to Shannon and Mary.
Well, thank you very much, Ashley, and thank you for organizing it, and I'm really pleased to see former students round the table. It's very reassuring. Really, the starting point for this book is very much as Bob put it. We call it the security gap, that the kind of risks and dangers that we face today, the so-called emerging threats, whether it's sectarian conflict, insurgencies, human rights violations, natural disasters, oil spills, hurricanes, floods, earthquakes or pandemics or famines. Those are the things that make people feel really, really insecure, and yet our security services largely consist of conventional military force that not only can't address these emerging risks and dangers, but when you try to use them in situations where these emerging risks and dangers exist, they make things worse. And we talk quite a lot about that in the book. One little addendum to all this. As a matter of fact, I think these risks, many of these risks and dangers were always there. There are some new elements that arise perhaps from globalization, from interconnectedness, from the loss of competitiveness as a result of a global market. So there are some new threats that do exist. But actually, I think what really changed was the end of the Cold War. That up to the end of the Cold War, we thought the worst imaginable thing that could happen was another world war. And that determined our way of thinking, how we related to our institutions. If our institutions were going to keep us safe from a world war, nothing else much mattered. And once that had disappeared, I think we suddenly became aware to a much greater degree of these emerging threats. So our concern was to address the question of the security gap, because while I don't think the security gap is empty, I think what's happened is that a myriad of private actors have moved in to address the security gap. And some of them are very good and well-meaning NGOs, private security companies, many less so, warlords, militias, criminal gangs. And I think my concern is twofold. One is that we really do, the legitimacy of our institutions really does depend on the belief that they keep us safe. And if we no longer trust our institutions to keep us safe and we feel we have to go to private sources, there's not much point in having them. And the other is that I think if all these private actors are rushing in and taking over the space, it's becoming an anarchy, a market, a vested interest in violence, which I think is very dangerous. So our concern was, how can we provide public provision for security? And what we've done is to develop the human security concept specifically in that way, as a way of saying this is what our security services should be like. And what I'm going to do now is to very briefly define what we mean by human security, and then talk about, which is the focus of the book, how do you implement human security? And I thought I would use Afghanistan as an example. So how do we define human security? Well, in our definition, and many of you know, there are many other definitions of human security, has three elements. The first element, which is common to all definitions of human security, is that it's about the security of the individual and the communities in which they live, rather than about the security of states or borders. The second element, which is more contested, is it's both about security from violent threats and security from environmental risks or material deprivation, from freedom from fear and freedom from want. That's how it was originally developed by UNDP in the 1994 Human Development Report. But actually, I think in the UN jargon, human security has become almost completely soft, if you like. It's almost completely about development. And I think our concern was very much to keep the focus on how do you act in conflicts where people are really violently threatened? But at the same time, we recognize that violence cannot be disentangled from material deprivation or from environmental risks. So it's interrelated. The Canadian definition of human security is really responsibility to protect, almost entirely focuses on protection from violence. So I guess we're somewhere in the middle. And the third element of our definition of human security is that it's about the blurring of the domestic and the international. We're used to assuming that we enjoy human security in well-ordered societies like the United States or Britain. if there is a crisis like the 7/7 bombings, for example, we have police, health services, firefighters who are at the spot very quickly, and if necessary, we can bring in the military to support them, as happened, for example, in the case of the oil spill. But we think that security abroad is just protecting our country against its enemies. And I think what we're saying with human security is that what we think nowadays is that you have to extend the kind of security we enjoy at home globally. It's security based on the rule of law and based on the presence of emergency forces. So it's, if you like, the extension of a law paradigm rather than a war paradigm. It's about the fact that actually if there are conflicts in different parts of the world because of interconnectedness, because of migration, they reach right into our inner cities. And so actually we have to take seriously insecurity in other parts of the world. So that's the definition. And I think it's important to have a concept because then people understand what their goal is and what they're working towards. But there's no point having a concept unless you think about how to implement it. And I think we were asked very often when writing the book, is this different from the new counterinsurgency doctrine? Because the new counterinsurgency doctrine is all about population security. For those of you who are not so familiar with it, the shift from counter-terror to counter-insurgency was said to be a shift from enemy-centric approaches to population-centric approaches. And Petraeus' new counterinsurgency manual has many of the same injunctions that we talk about in our human security concept. So is it different? Well, actually, I think it is different because I think that with counterinsurgency, population security is a means to an end, and the end is still defeating America's enemies, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Whereas for human security, it's the other way around. The end, in the case of, say, Afghanistan, would be the security of both Afghans and Americans. That's the goal. And maybe you might need to defeat Al-Qaeda or marginalize Al-Qaeda, whatever, in order to reach that goal. But your starting point is the goal. And it makes a difference, both in terms of the narrative, what you say you're doing, and how people, and whether people believe in you, but also in the rules of engagement. And in the case of Afghanistan, the fact that they hear on the television Obama and Petraeus saying our goal is to win against Al-Qaeda means that, that very often ordinary Afghans feel themselves to be a pawn in a big power game, and they don't know which side to trust. Are they going to be safer with the Taliban, or are they going to be safer with a government that's very abusive and is allied to a international community that's primarily concerned about defeating Al-Qaeda. So what we've done in thinking about how to implement, we argue that traditional armies need to be replaced by human security forces that would involve both military and civilians. They'd be like global emergency forces, but they would operate under a set of principles. It's not enough just to bring military and civilian together. It doesn't really work for a whole variety of reasons, which I'll explain. You have to have a changed concept of operations. And so we developed these six principles to explain the changed concept of operations. And what I'd like to do is to tell you these six principles and explain how things would be different in Afghanistan if you followed those principles. The first principle, which is the biggest break, if you like, with war fighting, is the principle of human rights. Human security is about protecting fundamental human rights, and that operates even in the midst of armed conflict. What that effectively means in the case of Afghanistan is really three things. First of all, it means that collateral damage is absolutely unacceptable. It's true that in the last 6 months or so, year or so, there's been a big effort to minimize civilian casualties, but it's still not nearly as tight as it would be within your own country. It's still the case that civilians get killed on night raids, and of course they get killed, but that's in Pakistan, in drone attacks, even if there's a minimum number. But if you were doing this domestically, you couldn't even afford that minimum number. The example I often give is actually the 7/7 bombers, where the bombers were in fact British citizens. So there was no way we could have sent a drone or a cruise missile against Huddersfield or Leeds, where the bombers were trained and made their networks. So collateral damage is almost unacceptable. I mean, obviously you have the right to shoot in self-defense or kill in self-defense or to protect a third party, but that's as you as policemen do, but that's much tighter than the rules of armed conflict. The second thing is that predation by the Afghan government, by local warlords, matters as much as the insurgency. That's human rights are being violated all over Afghanistan by local governors, local warlords. Their police and indeed the army, but less so, act in very predatory ways on people. And that is unacceptable under a human security doctrine. That's as important to deal with as it is with the insurgency, and that's the reason why so many people feel maybe they'll be safer with the Taliban, who at least provide basic stability and a rudimentary sense of justice, even if it's Islamic justice of a kind that many people hate, actually. So it's a balance of evils that many Afghans are facing. And the third point is that if you're thinking in human security terms, of course the enemy's human as well. And actually what you should be trying to do, in fact, they're not really, in human security terms, since that's more like a domestic rule of law, these guys are criminals rather than enemies. They may be very big criminals. They're operating, as it were, crimes against humanity. But they're criminals. And with criminals, what you do is you arrest them and you bring them to justice rather than to assume they're guilty. And that matters not just because they're human, not just for moral reasons, but also because I think the more that we attack Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the more young men are recruited to the cause. And so it really matters. If you're really serious about dealing with terrorism, you have, and I am very serious, you have to think about how to marginalize them rather than give them the legitimacy of being an enemy. So that's the first principle. The second principle, and I'll go faster through the rest because we won't have that much time if I take as much time as I did on the first. The second principle is legitimate political authority. And it's equally important because, in the end, human security can only be provided by a legitimate political authority, usually a state, but it could be a municipality, it could be an international administration. And the emphasis is on legitimacy, and by legitimacy I don't mean legality. I mean an institution that people trust, that they really believe keeps them safe. And in order to establish a legitimate political authority, you need to create space where citizens can debate together in a serious way and establish the sort of government they want that actually does the kind of thing they want. And that, of course, is the biggest problem in Afghanistan. The biggest problem is the Karzai government does not have that kind of legitimacy in Afghanistan, and that's the reason people are attracted to the Taliban. So if you're thinking about the role of the military in this case, the job is stability rather than victory. The job is to create humanitarian space rather than to defeat the enemy. The third principle, which is actually part of legitimate political authority, but we made it separate because it's so important, is bottom-up. That is to say, the population are the people in the end who are going to create their own society, establish their own institutions, and so therefore they have to be engaged and involved in the process. And the tendency, although that's changing in Afghanistan, and there are areas where real bottom-up approaches are adopted, by and large, the tendency on the part of the international community is to talk to the warlords and the political leaders and not to ordinary people. And that's a huge mistake, because not only are ordinary people key to understanding how you deal with the warlords, you do have to talk to the warlords and political leaders, but you need guidance from people who really understand the local situation. And that means you need to get engaged in serious discussions about with people about what's happening. And in fact, you know, Afghans, there's a tendency to think Afghans are traditional, they don't know how to do these things, but you have to remember that Afghans have been at war now for several decades. Many of them have been refugees, have been displaced people, have lived in different countries. These traditional structures are often structures that were invented under the Taliban. And many of them are rather sophisticated because they've had these kinds of experiences, a lot more sophisticated than we tend to assume. The fourth principle is effective multilateralism. That's both about operating within an international rule of law, but also about operating coherently. And in all current missions, but especially in Afghanistan, there's huge numbers of different agencies, NGOs, militaries, and coordinating them is a nightmare. And actually, it's very hard to coordinate them in an institutional way, because you tend to then create yet another institutional layer. But I think the key is coordination through conceptual coherence rather than institutional coherence. And in Afghanistan, I think particularly, there's a huge problem. I mean, first of all, there's a problem that there are two commands, even though Petraeus is now the commander of both. There's the ISAF command and Operation Enduring Freedom, and they have different missions. ISAF is about stability operations, and Operation Enduring Freedom is about the war on terror. But also, that's a problem all the way down. There are many NGOs who feel they don't want to be associated with the war on terror, but they do want to get involved and to do good things. And so they're operating independently and autonomously. And so what you really need is to have a common story that everyone can accept. And there's no way the human security, many of the, not only the NGOs, but many of the Europeans are happy about the war on terror, but they can maybe have conceptual coherence around a concept of stability, and particularly around a concept of human security. That's the fourth principle. The fifth principle is regional focus, and that's almost so obvious I don't really need to talk about it. It's simply that these kinds of complex operations, humanitarian emergencies, simply don't respect national borders, and you can't focus on one particular place. They spread through ideologies, they spread through transnational crime, they spread through refugees and displaced persons. And so in Afghanistan, you have to deal with the situation in Pakistan, everyone knows that, but also Iran, Uzbekistan. And the final principle is clear, transparent civilian command. And here I come back to the problem of the military and the civil working together. It's very difficult for civilian agencies to work with military agencies, military, if they think the military are engaged in a shooting war, because they know they're going to be targets. They know they're going to be implicated. I mean, the criticism, some of you may be familiar with the human terrain teams. These are the anthropologists recruited to help the military in Afghanistan and to identify clans and religious holidays and so on. And they've been hugely criticized by the Anthropological Association because they've the feeling that anthropologists shouldn't be used to identify enemies. But of course, it's a completely different story if anthropologists are going to be used for human security. And so military and civilians working together first means they do have to be working around a human security concept. Otherwise, it's extremely difficult for the civilians. And secondly, I think human security operations have to be civilian operations. The military have to be subordinated to civilians, and the civilians have to feel there's a civilian in charge. Otherwise, I think it's extremely difficult for them to work effectively. And I do think that's one of the biggest problems in Afghanistan. The McChrystal report I really liked that was produced last summer and informed the surge in Afghanistan. I thought it was a great report if it could be put into practice. But I think the big weakness was that it should have been the Holbrooke report. It should have been the report by the civilian leadership in Afghanistan, and it shouldn't have been the military implementing it all. I mean, I know the reasons why this is. The civilian leadership is much weaker. The military get this to a much greater degree than the civilians get it because of their actual experience on the ground. And, you know, I think AID, the same with the State Department, you know, the civilian aspects of foreign policy have absolutely been denuded over the last two decades. So we don't have the civilian capacity. But nevertheless, that is a huge problem. And it's a huge problem not just because of the orders, but also because I think however hard you try to change the military culture, it's extremely difficult to do it. Even though McChrystal says you mustn't shoot civilians and you must be doing governance and you must be talking to locals, to get that kind of assimilated by soldiers who have been trained for war fighting is extremely difficult. So those are the principles, the six principles. And what I'd like to do really is to just say two things before I hand over. No, actually, I want to say three things before I hand over to Shannon. First, I want to tell you a little bit about, to say something about the criticisms we've received. And we've received two sets of criticisms. One is more political. One is that we get criticisms from the left that human security is a new form of imperialism, interventionism. It's what Chomsky calls military humanism. And it's just a new justification for big power intervention. And the other is from the right, which is that human security is rather naive. It's too soft. You've got to have the hard stuff, really, to deal with the really serious problems, with the violent enemies, with the foreign states. And I think on the latter, my answer is that actually human security is hard. The fact that we argue very strongly in the book and that the military are actually engaged, that you do need robust forces in certain really difficult situations. And not only that, but you need to be able to actually use them and use them in a very, very risky way, because you're asking soldiers to be more like police and firefighters, to risk their lives to save others, rather than in a sort of classic warfighting position where you have much more force protection and your primary goal is killing the enemy. I mean, in fact, if you look at warfighting, many fewer soldiers are killed in classic warfighting, like in the NATO war over Kosovo. There were almost no Western casualties at all. So it's very hard. Human security is a hard concept. And I actually think that the weapon systems we acquire are actually soft. They're intended for communication. They're intended for deterrence. They're not actually intended to be used. And so I think they're soft rather than hard, if soft means communication. And I do think that if their actual use would probably be the worst humanitarian catastrophe one could imagine. So what we're really saying is human security means doing things for a humanitarian goal, but doing them through humanitarian means. If the most important thing in signaling what we want is to signal that we don't want a future interstate war. And that, I think, it's not clear to me whether the signal we send says it is a signal of deterrence or a signal that weapon systems are a sign of big power politics, and anyone who wants to compete with us should do the same. So I think there's a real problem about the hard, soft argument. The left argument, I think, is also problematic, and it really worries me in the case of Afghanistan, the polarization. On the one side, there are those who say we should go on being in Afghanistan and do what we're doing, and on the other side, there are those who say we should withdraw. And I think both options are very dangerous, even from the point of view of American security. They're, both options are very bad for Afghans. If we withdraw, we leave Afghans at the mercy of warlords and the Taliban. But also, what we're doing at the moment is creating more recruits to Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and if we withdraw, we are creating a safe haven for Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So it really does require a change of strategy, and there is has to be a middle position. The other set of criticisms we've had is more practical. There are those who say we're doing it already, and there are those who say it's utopian. The we're doing it already, I think, does have a lot of truth. I think the last two decades have been a huge learning experience. I do think we're trying to learn to use the military and civilians together. I do think the growth in international peacekeeping, the new emphasis on protection of civilians, has developed a lot, and I think that's illustrated by the figures that you've seen over the last two decades, not only a decline in the number of conflicts, but a decline in the number of people killed in conflicts, despite Iraq and Afghanistan, which I think are outliers because the use of military force actually made them worse in classic ways. So I do think to some extent we're doing it already, but I think we're not doing it enough. And we don't have a conceptual framework. And I think that's why we need to take it further. And I think the fact that we're doing it already means that it is practical. But I also think there is a utopian element. And the utopian element is that we are saying that you have to treat Afghans or Iraqis as though they were Americans or and British, that Afghan lives are equal to American lives. And although we all believe that in theory, in practice, that is extremely difficult to put into practice. And, you know, it does mean putting civilian protection, for example, before force protection. It's really, really difficult to do that in practice. And I think that is a bit utopian, but as I always say, I think it's quite good to have some utopian goals. The final thing I wanted to say, which is why I said I had three more things I wanted to say, is simply how Shannon and I got together. Because I think we have a very, very different trajectory. I think for time reasons, I'm not really going to go through the whole story, which I do sometimes, but essentially, you know, Shannon's a soldier, a West Pointer, an army officer, and I come from a background in peace and human rights. And so we've sort of converged on the same position. And in fact, it was the post-Cold War period. It was realizing that when you have ethnic cleansing and genocide and massive violations of human rights, you do need to use force. And at the same time, Shannon realizing that using force to protect people doesn't require advanced aircraft, tanks, and actually needs much more of an emphasis on development, on things like water, sanitation, clearing unexploded ordnance. I think for me it was also realizing, yes, we need force, but actually how you force isn't just a black box that can be applied. And that's something I learned out of Kosovo. You can't just decide to bomb people in order to stop ethnic cleansing. So actually how you use force really matters. After 2001, I was asked by Javier Solana, the High Representative for Common and Foreign and Security Policy of the European Union, to convene a study group to think about what kind of European security capabilities Europe should have. And we had a study group involving practitioners and academics from all over Europe, and many of the principles that I've described came out of that study group. We concluded that the EU shouldn't have an army in a traditional way. It should rather have a military civilian force capable of contributing to global operations. And we decided it was important to give it a name. So after a lot of thought, we came up with the title Human Security. And our first report was called A Human Security Doctrine for Europe. And subsequently, we realized it wasn't enough to have a doctrine. You needed a strategy as well. And so our second report was called A European Way of Security. So it was the fact that I had written these reports. Shannon, meanwhile, was working for AFRICOM as a senior analyst, and he read the reports and thought this had something relevant to what AFRICOM was doing. And so he sent me an email, and that led to a conversation which culminated in the book. Sorry, I've talked too long, but never mind.
Okay, thank you, Ashley and Bob. Thanks to CSIS and all of you for being here. I'll start with a disclaimer. Even though I am in the personality restraint costume, these opinions and views do not reflect those of the Department of Defense or the United States Army. They're entirely my own, and I take responsibility for those. But to pick up on what Mary was talking about how we met, I think that's one of the interesting things, the story behind the story within the book is how you get a peace activist and an Army officer together. And I start by saying, when people ask how Mary and I met, I said, just like every other good relationship in the 21st century, we met online. But the reality is, and I'll focus in a little bit on when I was senior Africa analyst at the Pentagon, and I was asked by the chief staff of the Army to prepare a briefing on security for Africa to the chief of staff and his senior military officers, 4 stars and 3 stars. And I started off my briefing by these 2 points. First off, I said Africa is a continent, it's not a country. And secondly, there's a reason that it's shaped like a question mark, because we really don't understand what makes security in Africa. Now, I said that very audaciously and was pretty proud of myself as a young major until I looked out and saw my 3-star sweating bullets, and I realized that probably by the end of that presentation I'd be flipping hamburgers at McDonald's, because he certainly looked like he was going to be supervising me flipping those hamburgers at McDonald's. But to the chief of staff's credit, he challenged myself and a couple of other individuals to go out and to actually find out. He said, sure. He goes, so tell me what it is. How is it that Africans view security? And this was about the time that AFRICOM was about to be announced. And so it was very relevant. So we had the opportunity on this certain project to go out and to canvas 12, 13 countries, had the opportunity to talk with about 80 or 90 different various groups, individuals, ranging all the way from ministers of defense, chiefs of defense, NGOs, academics, practitioners, all the way down to 2 or 3 Somali taxi cab drivers here in Washington, D.C. And the question that we asked was very simple. How is it that you view your security? I'm a political scientist by training and nature, so I didn't say how is it that you should view your security. I didn't say how is it you the United States Defense Department should view security. How is it that you view your security? And the answers that came back were resoundingly similar, a bit sobering, and quite puzzling for a military officer. Here's what the answers came back with, about a 90% coherence. First and foremost, Africans talked about their security in terms of security sector reform, not the type of SSR security sector reform that we discuss here in the United States. We'll get to that here in just a second. The other thing that they talked about were poverty. They discussed health. They discussed climate change, environmental shocks, natural disaster. Now, this is not a discussion with solely NGOs. This is not a discussion with developmental experts. These are discussions with chiefs of defense. These are discussions with ministers of defense. These are discussions with top military leaders on the African continent. And this is what they were saying. So we brought that back and we looked at it and said, wow, what do we do with this? How are we going to articulate this to the chief of staff? And what we realized is we didn't have the strategic narrative. We didn't have the language capable of explaining this. So one of the things that I always discuss is this. You can only achieve those things for which you have words. You can only accomplish those things for which you have the language. And we came about that honestly because as we began looking at how would we articulate these types of security concerns that Africans brought to us in 20th century military doctrine, 20th century military terminology, we couldn't do it. So that's really when Mary and I got together because I started looking, saying there has to be some type of framework out there. I mean, this is, again, we don't want to skew the facts. So how is it that we're going to better be able to articulate this? Now, why is this important? Why was this so troubling? Because, as you know, within the military, we very much have looked at things in the 20th century as well as the 19th and 18th century in terms of what we call in the military is kinetic terms, kinetic-based threats. For any physicists in the room, I got it. We don't use the term kinetic correctly, but what we mean is this. Kinetic-based threats are threats from ground forces, threats from air forces, threats from land forces, threats from air forces, planes, tanks, guns, a 344th motorized rifle regiment lining up along the Fulda Gap to invade. We got them. That's our threat right there. It's solving for the silver bullet. It's solving for that one variable that determines what your response is going to be. That's been pretty much the discussion and the discourse of the 20th century. It's been very much an algebraic type of equation. Solve for the one variable and you'll know how to attack it. Yet if you think about it, the two greatest attacks on the United States happened at the beginning of the 21st century. And neither one of those came from a kinetic-based state threat. 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina. So if you start looking at that, how would we shift this language? How would we shift this ugly word paradigm to better encompass what we're going to be seeing? Instead of focusing on land forces, air forces, naval forces, perhaps we need to shift to looking more at forces of nature. Instead of looking at kinetic-based threats, perhaps we should shift to a conditions-based model of creeping vulnerabilities. Creeping vulnerabilities. What do I mean by that? Well, let's discuss each one of these ideas that African leadership and Africans talk to me about as their security concerns. If you took each one of these as a card, health, environment, poverty, gender inequality, all of these, and you held them up, each one of those individually is not specifically a threat. Yet if you were to take these cards and begin to build a house of cards, what would happen if one of those cards was pulled out? Well, it wouldn't really matter which card it was that's pulled out. But what you could guarantee is that system, that house, would fall. What you wouldn't know is how quickly it would fall. What you wouldn't know is which direction it would fall. You wouldn't know if it was going to hit the house next to it and make it fall. But what you can guarantee is that house is going to fall. Yet individually, none of these is considered a threat. Water and sanitation? Brief that to the Secretary of Defense as our next great threat. You'd be laughed out of the office. Yet taken as part of a systems of systems approach, as part of this creeping vulnerabilities, what you begin to see is these things cannot be pulled apart from one another. They're inextricably linked. They skew the lines, as Mary discussed. They skew the lines of how we traditionally see threats, yet for any of you that know what kudzu, I grew up in the South, so kudzu, it's a lot like kudzu, this really nasty little vine that it just continues to grow and grow and chokes everything out if you don't get to it quickly enough. Yet we continue to wait until these types of vulnerabilities become kinetic. One of the examples that I always give is the old Chinese adage of, you know, you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, you teach a man a fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Well, when it comes to Somalia, the question is, what happens when you take all a man's fish away? You create a pirate. And now we're seeing this issue of Somali piracy as a kinetic-based threat. Did it start that way? And yes, there are some very unsavory characters that, yes, they are bad, and yes, they should be killed or captured. But by and large, what is going on there in those waters is not about evil terrorism. It's very much about desperate populations looking for anything to provide for livelihoods. Why in the world would you take a non-seaworthy ship 500 miles off the coast to try to attack a ship if you can fish and you can provide for your family close to home? But that's what we've seen there with the overfishing of the Gulf of Aden and those things. So again, creeping vulnerabilities. So the challenge is very much bringing a new language that allows for a coherence to see these things that have traditionally been on the periphery. A lot of the work that I do is with climate change and environmental security and those kinds of things. And when I hear these discussions, they continue to be discussed on the periphery because the language is not there. The narrative is not there that allows this to be seen as part of a greater whole. No, climate change is not the cause of war in Darfur. No, climate change will not be the cause for the Third World War. Nor will anything else individually. These things are linked together. And that's what's so terribly important to see. Now, am I advocating that the Department of Defense take on everything, everywhere, for everyone? Absolutely not. What I am saying is that language needs to change where we stop looking at things in terms of defense and start opening the aperture to see things in terms of security, where we start looking and saying, hey, who are our experts that can help provide for these solutions and working in unison? A lot of times I go to a lot of conferences on Africa, developmental community, and we discuss, you know, we're not doing enough in Africa. Well, I would be the skunk at the party that stands up and say, is that actually the challenge, or is it perhaps we're not doing enough together in Africa? And many times that is very much the case, that the right hand doesn't know what the left is doing. Sort of the old who's on first routine. But again, until that language is there, we continue to do these things in silos of excellence. We continue to defend our Fabergé rice bowls and say, that's my lane, not yours, instead of opening this up and saying, look, we all have a role to play in this. And that's very important. Why? Because we no longer have, here in the United States, we no longer have the protection of the ponds. We no longer have the ability to see the far side and near side and be able to enjoy that human security at home while just sort of expecting whatever happens in Africa or the Far East or the Middle East to just sort of take care of itself. Why is that? Because, again, the blurring of lines between international and domestic security, it's very much turned into an intermestic type of affair. An example of that, well, again, I'll take you back to Somalia. Why is it that we have one of the largest ongoing FBI investigations in the United States happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota? Why is that? And a lot of it, in turn, is because of the interconnectedness and the ability of people. These issues have always been there. I'm not saying that these issues have just started emerging, but the ability to connect, the power of mobile technologies, the power of the internet, these kinds of things where traditionally these threats have just sort of stayed in one area, and now they're able to spread. This time lag is compressed down so heavily, we don't have the luxury of saying, well, it's just going to affect over there. It's not going to affect us here. We can only achieve those things for which we have language. But I'm a sort of a coffee cup half full kind of guy, so I'd like to talk a little bit about what I discuss as solutions not yet sought. If we were to shift to this type of language, how would it look? What are some examples? And one of the things that we discuss in the book is the concept of engagement brigades. And Mary talks a lot about it in terms of the international setting, but I'll talk with you a little bit about it in terms of the state setting or in terms of what some African leadership and African military leadership has discussed with me. There's a lot of frustration with African militaries that, gosh, they just can't get it, or, you know, they're tough to train, they're tough to equip, these kinds of things. Well, is it perhaps that we don't understand what they're asking for? And I'll use an example of Angola. I had the opportunity to talk with the chief of staff while I was over there. And one of the we were at a meeting much like this with a lot of the attachés, and the Angolan military had agreed to draw down its forces from 160,000 to I think it was 100 or 120,000, something like that, within a couple of years after their civil war is over. And so we're sitting there, and one of the attachés said, "General, we understand that, you know, you have 155,000 men under arms, and your promise was that you were going to have this drawn down by approximately 30 or 40,000 men by this time. Why have you failed to do this?" And General Furtado, without blinking an eye, he looked at the attaché, and he said, "This is correct. We very much want to draw down our forces. But considering that the only training and skills these individuals have is pulling a trigger, I don't see how that's going to help the stability and security of this country." And he went on to say something that was very interesting, that they are looking to change their forces from a defense force to something that they can utilize for vocational training, that they can utilize for infrastructure development, that they can utilize for engineering types of projects, water and sanitation, health. They're taking the motorized or their infantry brigades, and they're converting them over. They're converting them over to this thing. They've got a thing called the ultimate building machine that they're using. It's a thing, and we discuss it in the book, but basically can build a 10,000-square-foot building in about 10 hours with 10 trained guys. Amazing. Amazing stuff. They're taking an infantry brigade and converting it over to an ultimate building brigade. And so this is where we start to talk about the idea of engagement brigades. And this sort of spirit spills over, and it concerns a lot of the NGO community that this is the militarization of humanitarian space, that kind of thing. Yet the intent here is that in many countries in the developing world, it's not just in Africa, that the only viable functioning organ of that government, the only functioning portion of that government is usually the military. So why is it that you can't use the military to train and to give vocational skills, which is, in development terms, usually what is holding a country back is the lack of trained and skilled labor? Why can't you use those military forces, convert them to human security forces, give them those skills, and then allow them to assimilate into the civilian sector? That's the concept of an engagement brigade from a state type of model. We could also mirror that on an international model with disaster, with response forces, with brigades that work with, you know, farming and those kinds of things. So these are all possibilities. And that's very important. And I know we're running a little bit short on time, so I want to close very quickly, and we can get to some other ideas and questions and answers. But I was at a conference and had the opportunity to talk with the former president of Nigeria, and we were discussing security in Africa, and he pulled me aside. And he said, "One thing that's very important for the United States to understand, Africa now has choices in their strategic partners. It doesn't have to be the United States. Africans, the developing world, will take solutions that better conform to their problems. Instead of us giving the world our definition of what is right for their security, perhaps it is time that we start to listen to what they say is relevant for their security." And I leave on a very positive note, because the thing that has made this country so great has been the power of our ideas, the power to understand what it is that makes up the problem and adapt our systems and adapt our solutions to most fit those challenges. And I think we can do it. And with that, I thank you very much and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Shannon and Mary. So now is the question and answer portion of the event. As the moderator, I'm going to reserve the right to ask the first question. And I apologize in advance if I'm making you take things out of the conceptual realm and put them into the implementation round. As you know, it's a global economic crisis. We have an election season coming up. There's calls for cuts. It's kind of a prime time for someone, in your case, to propose an alternative way of doing things that, from what I gathered in the book, will be less expensive than the traditional military way that we are doing things. That being said, if you had the President of the United States ear and he was open to the solution and said, "I want to do this today," what recommendations would you make to get this off the ground? How does it start? Where is it housed? Is it a U.S.-led? Is it an international one? I just wanted to know how you operationalize this, per se.
Do you want me to start? I'm sure you have things to say. It's a very good question. First thing I'd say is, why don't you rename the National Security Council the Human Security Council? and bring everybody into it. Bring the State Department, Homeland Security, the Department of Defense, and sort of really start thinking in a holistic way and overcoming the silos of government. Then I would say, actually, we need a shift within the defense budget from very expensive advanced weapon systems. That's beginning to happen, but it could just be speeded up. We need towards people, and we also need a big increase in civilian capacities, both diplomatic capacities. I think when people talk about civilian capacities, they often forget diplomatic capacities, including a new kind of diplomacy, which isn't just state to state, but is people to people as well, which is actually happening in the European Union. I think it's quite one of the exciting things is the establishment of this new External Action Service, which is going to be focused on crisis management, but also all sorts of other civilian rosters, which are beginning, but are inadequate for police, for health workers, for development workers, and so on. And I would train all these guys together, the new military and the civilians. I'd have a huge training program, and they'd all get together, and we'd have joint exercises, human security exercises, rather than the sort of exercises, the war-fighting exercises, which now predominate. I'd have a big shift in intelligence, away from top-down, technology-driven intelligence. I might even dismantle the CIA and the DIA and start a new human intelligence agency, I think. Anyway, this is off the top of my head, but these are the kinds of things I would do if I were president. But over to Shannon. Oh, by the way, just one other thing. I think it would still be an American Human Security Council, because I think the UN is only as strong as its member nations. So although I'd like to see a permanent UN rapid reaction human security force, I think that would remain quite small, and it would be up to member states like the United States and, I hope, eventually Russia. I'd start a dialogue with Russia and China, by the way, about emerging threats and non-traditional threats and how we can do things together. And, well, there's lots more to say, but I'll let Shannon say some.
I think the first thing that's most important is embracing the language, the shift in the narrative. And that has to come from the top, because what I've seen as I've gone through here and people ask, you know, how's this being received over at the Pentagon? And there's two very strong camps. One camp is the traditional bureaucracy that is sort of the vanguard of status quo. And they are used to seeing things as they are. In the 20th century, they don't want to see that change. So, you know, we have the war on terror. Well, just take out communism, put in terror, and you've got your battle that you never fought. Old wine and new bottles. But the other thing that I see, and I get a number of emails from young captains and lieutenants saying, "Sir, we read your book. We really wish we would have had this on our first tour, or second tour, or third or fourth tour over in Iraq or Afghanistan. We really wish that our commanders could see this in this type of language, because it makes that much more sense." But that group, it will take years to change that unless there is a drive from the top down saying we need this shift in the narrative. And I think that's also important internationally, because regardless of what administration is in the White House right now, when you go across many parts of the world, it's still very much viewed as us against them. Very much the U.S., you're either with us or against us, and if you're against us, we're coming after you. And that has to change if there's going to be any kind of meaningful, sustainable type of security and engagement. So I think that's important. The second thing I would do is look at the duplicity of efforts in so many different areas. I mean, we're doing, again, an efficiencies model, and there's so much that we're doing four, five, six times over without even understanding that it's happening in another part of the government. And I'll give one really quick example, and we'll go back to questions. But when we were doing this study, we had a number of probably 12 different U.S. Agencies in the room, and we were talking about police training. and said, okay, how many folks in here are doing police training with your agencies? And I think it was about 8 or 9 agencies raised their hands. And then so we started necking it down and said, okay, well, in this specific country, who's doing training? And 5 agencies raised their hand. We said, okay, within this country, in this city, 5 agencies held their hands up. I said, okay, within this city, is everybody training the same police force? And everyone starts looking around. What was even more telling, they didn't know that they were doing this. Secondly, one organization was a subsidiary of another organization, and they didn't even know that they were training these forces. And one of the comments was made was, we thought they were just incredible learners with our 2 weeks of training. So, again, it's a matter of understanding that who's on first routine, of understanding what is going on. And, oh, by the way, that ambassador did not know this was going on. So that being said, we need to start looking around and trying to have an efficiencies model. So we can leverage more money in the right spots rather than all of these things going on. I think those are the two greatest things. And finally, the thing I would say is this isn't going to happen quickly. I mean, this isn't going to happen overnight, because you're talking about very embedded bureaucracies that have been and designed for state-based type of engagements and operations that have been around for 50, 60, 70 years. It ain't going to happen overnight. But finding those pilot projects, those fairly non-confrontational things, and developing those interagency models, I think, are very important.
Thank you. Now I'm going to open up the floor to questions. When you're called on, please state your name and affiliation and press the on button on the microphone as this event is being recorded. And, oh, just a disclaimer, remember it's question and answer, not statement and response, so please get to your question quickly.
Hi, Michael Lund, Management Systems International here in town and occasional other places. The overall thrust of this is obviously very valid and timely and good. Although, as Mary alluded, it could be argued that this discourse has been in the mix for some years. I mean, going back to culture of prevention of the UN, for example, in the mid-90s. While it's good to shift the paradigm and the language and the tone and the concepts, I'd like to kind of go back to what Robert introduced. How, and a little bit what Ashley was asking about at the top level, how do you actually operationalize this amalgamation of security and development in terms of different stages of conflict, in terms of weak state context versus stronger state conflicts? Context, in terms of are we talking about that at the national level? Are we talking about the village level? It doesn't, you know, stating all the arguments and the principles and reframing the language, which is important, doesn't give you guidance as to whether human rights in this context should be prioritized over security, should be prioritized over governance, should be prioritized over reconciliation between groups. So I think the next step in this discussion has to be more concrete by, among other things, sketching out what kinds of strategies, in a generic sense, obviously they can't be stated in a blanket way, are fitting to different kinds of contexts. That your discussion has been mainly generated by Afghanistan, perhaps Iraq. But the discourse has been talking about conflict prevention for some years, not just mid-conflict situations and not just post-conflict situations. So I think we need to move to more discussion of what the experience of the international community, NGOs, et cetera, has been in terms of what kinds of instruments are effective at what contexts. And then to set up a process for achieving the conceptual coherence, which you know, I think is a very important thing here. It's not a matter of jiggering the organizational structure, but getting everybody on the same board. But you've got to be able to communicate that, and you've got to convene people to focus on particular problems in particular countries at particular times. So I'm wondering whether you can move a little bit down the road in those terms.
Just to say, I used Afghanistan as an example because I thought that would be of interest here. But actually, these ideas have been shaped by a number of different contexts: the Balkans, Africa, the Middle East. So this isn't a peculiarly... I could go through the same principles and I have done. You know, we could talk about Israel, Palestine, and I could talk about the principles. So that's the first thing. And indeed, the whole point of what we're saying is that actually every situation is unique. There's a different strategy for every situation, but these are a set of principles, a kind of checklist. And we've been doing it with European missions, for example, using this as a checklist for evaluation. So it's the principles that apply. On the issue of phase, I'm very critical of the whole idea of phases of conflict. I think the kind of conditions that lead to conflict, which you deal with in conflict prevention, are even worse after a conflict. And so reconstruction has to be a prevention strategy.
Of course. Yeah.
And I think many of these things operate throughout conflict. I don't think there's one strategy for prevention, one strategy during conflict, and one strategy for reconstruction. I'm very critical of that way of thinking, and I think you have to deal with all of these factors in varying degrees depending on the situation. I think the other thing that you say, I mean, there's a lot actually in the book about weak states, and I tend to think that what we call as strong states, authoritarian states, are often weak states because they're lacking legitimacy, and actually, many of the things that we're talking about are a product primarily of weak states, even though I guess there was a stronger state structure in Iraq than there was, for example, in Afghanistan. But what I think is terribly important is that we think of today's contemporary conflicts in a different way from the way we used to think about conflicts, in the sense that I think today's contemporary conflicts do involve, if you like, conflict entrepreneurs. They're rather different from the Clausewitzian type of contest of wills, which meant that conflicts became more extreme. Today's conflicts are persistent because there are groups that have either political or economic interests in the continuation of conflict. And what that means is that reconciliation may not be the right appropriate response. You may need to do reconciliation. You may need to bring these people together, the warring parties together. But actually, the warring parties are usually groups that within a non-violent situation would never have any power at all. They've created their power through violence. And if you want to end violence, you have to involve other groups and you have to develop justice. And I think justice is almost more important than reconciliation, dealing with these guys as criminals rather than as respectable political leaders, even though there are compromises all the time that you have to make. You know, we talk about talks with the Taliban as a way of ending the conflict. I can't imagine anything worse if I were an Afghan to imagine a political settlement that involves an agreement between the warlords and the Taliban. On the other hand, that might be a necessary condition for creating other things, but one would have to understand that it was a necessary condition. And so I think every situation is different. Every village situation is different. And what you can do at a village situation is very different from what you can do at a national situation. So, you know, while I think, yes, you're absolutely right, we've got to talk about all these different situations, I think what we're trying to do here is to develop a kind of conceptual framework and a set of principles that will help inform how we deal with these specific situations.
The only thing that I would add to that is, as far as, again, changing the mindset, because, you know, you talk about dealing with NGOs in various phases of war. The Chief Staff of the Army has said, you know, that we're in an era of persistent conflict. Yet when you look at our National Training Center, when you look at our Joint Readiness Training Center, when we were in a state of what we thought was peace, we trained for war. Yet now that we're in a perpetual or a persistent conflict, we still continue to train for that war. That mindset has to shift because we are still preparing for the conflict, and then we go in, we do all the kinetic stuff, and then after, in phase four operations is what it's called, then that's when we go, okay, well, now things are sort of settled out, things are broken, now we'll bring in the NGOs and we'll bring in the development community to help out. But there's enough studies out there that say that, you know, once things break, they stay broken. So why not look at that again from a human security perspective and say, why isn't that we're trying to look to prevent this from ever happening at the outset? Why is it that we can't change? And again, these are my opinions. But looking at changing one of these training centers, Joint Readiness Training Center or the National Training Center, to start looking at bringing in all of these mutual actors from the outset and looking at what conflicts or potential conflicts are happening right now and then preventing those rather than practicing on how to, you know, put them back together. So I think that's something that we can look at as well.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Ashley. Colonel Rick Nucio, I'm a visiting fellow here with CSIS, U.S. Army. I'm curious about, and again, if we, and I understand your language piece, if we, first question, and I hate multiple part questions, but I'm doing it. How do we fast forward the language in the international community to get some of these, as Mary, as you pointed out, these authoritarian states that are weak, how do we overcome that perception that we are here to help with whatever force we end up creating? You know, the second part I'm concerned is cost. Again, yeah, great savings if we got rid of the CIA, but we know that's not going to happen. But really, where does the funding come for this? So it's really, it's a matter of I guess it's actually three questions. How do we fast forward the international community? How do we overcome the perception that this is the United States, and as again pointed out, an imperialistic problem, or maybe we're trying to impose imperialistic will, and then cost? I mean, how do you get through those three fundamental issues?
I'll take a couple of those, and as far as the how do we convince other regimes, other states that we're serious about this? What you do it on the ground. You form this. You show that how this works on the ground, and it's not gonna, I mean, there's going to be as much learned through our failures as there are our successes. One of the things that I talk about over at Africa Command right now, they're doing a thing called the Africa Partnership Station, which is a very, very novel idea, and it's a growing type of concept where they steam a ship around the west coast of Africa and do things that are not military at all. They are very much supporting those governments or those countries and what they say their concerns are. And the very first time they did it, it was ugly. And there was a lot of failures. And to their credit, they said, we got it. We failed at this. We're going to do it better next time. And they did, and they continue to improve upon that. And something that started out with a lot of skepticism. I mean, the Nigerian press said, you know, there were subs that were floating around underneath, and they were spying and all this other kind of good stuff. Wasn't the case, but that being said, you know, now the perception is pretty positive, and we have to have those kinds of engagements across the globe. Again, the proof's in the pudding. Let's not talk about it. Let's start showing how it can be done and get partners together saying, yeah, okay, we can buy into this because you are now you're doing this in interest. And again, going back to the cost. When you start looking at, okay, who's the expert in this? You know, within the Army, we sort of have expertise, limited expertise in everything, but we're not really the subject matter expert in that. Instead of trying to, you know, kludge an infantry battalion into a civil affairs battalion that does X, Y, and Z, why not bring in your developmental experts? Why not bring in your USAIDs, your forestry services, and these kinds of things and say, look, we're going to be doing this. We need you to help us out. We have the funding for it, and so, again, that starts freeing up the budgets. And then, again, all along the way, annotating the successes and the failures and taking those back, and then what you'll see is a transformation happening, I think.
I'm going to try and be brief because of time. First, I think it's really important. We emphasize narrative, but narrative is also about doing. And in the end, perceptions change because they see what's being done. I think it's really important that American operations operate, are seen as part of a global operations and not merely unilateral American operations. And I think it's really important what's actually done. On the cost side, I think there is, I mean, one of the figures we quote in the book is that the peacekeeping budget of the UN is 0.5% of the US defense budget. So I do think a lot of restructuring within defense would be a way of funding all this. But I would also make another argument, which is that I think we are in the midst of a fundamental economic crisis that isn't purely a financial crisis. I think it's a fundamental crisis of, if you like, the 20th century model of development. And if we want a renewed phase of economic growth, I think it's got to be much more global and redistributive, and it's got to be much greener and more resource-saving. And actually, there's a real possibility of a new phase of economic growth. That's the way we're going to get out of the economic crisis. And in all, I think doing something like human security is actually a precondition for all that, because actually you do need development in other parts of the world, so they buy our resource-saving goods and so on. We do need a big redistribution, but that's simply not possible to get any economic improvement in the current security situations that many countries face. So my feeling is that actually it would start to pay for itself once it got going.
All right, time for one last question. Jennifer?
Yeah, Jennifer Cook with the CSIS Africa program. Well, obviously, I agree with so many of the themes in the book, but it seems like we're still in an international context that recognizes the sovereignty of states. And I think, you know, if you look at the battle to get even a small AU peacekeeping force into Darfur, if you look at the struggles to maintain MONUC in DRC, you have to recognize that as well. I don't think we would have gone into Afghanistan simply to fix condition-based threats. And you wonder then how long can you justify staying in there with blood and treasure and so forth to the American people or even the international community if your ultimate goal is to kind of fix the many problems that are there. So in some ways, U.S., you know, it broadens our agenda so much that it makes it very hard, I think, to justify in an international regime and to the American people, I think. Politically. Although, again, I'm behind everything that's said in the report.
I mean, I think we're moving into a world where we have a changed definition of sovereignty. It's less true for the United States because the United States is a big country. And so it can afford to act unilaterally, but most countries can't. And most countries are beginning to realize that their security depends on global security. And in a way, that was one of my personal motivation for writing the book, which is that actually I think a lot of these ideas are more prevalent elsewhere in the world, not in Russia and China, I have to say. That's a big... or even in India, but in Europe, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America, and I really wanted to get this debate taken forward in this country. And I think that it is a matter of people coming to rethink. I mean, it's so deeply embedded in the United States that the job of the government is to defend America against foreign enemies. I mean, it comes from the Second World War, and it's deeply, and we talk about how deeply embedded it is in the book, but actually it isn't actually solving the problems of security. So it does require people to think in a different way about security, about America and about America's role in the world. There has to be a different way of thinking, and I think that's a huge barrier. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a huge barrier to what's being done, but it needs to change, because unless it changes, we are going to see a continuing security gap, and we're going to see the rise of racist, xenophobic groups that become more and more powerful, which I think we're seeing both in this country and in Europe, which for me is very alarming. On the issue, the other side of the coin, you know, overcoming sovereignty, which I guess was part of your question, you know, do we intervene in places like Darfur or Afghanistan? I mean, most of the time, the problem is not that countries don't want their sovereignty violated. Those are the exceptions. Most of the time, countries are desperate for help. I was actually not in favor of the initial intervention in Afghanistan, but I feel now we have a responsibility to stay. In the case of Darfur, a lot of people were talking about the genocide in Darfur, but actually when the UN was trying to mobilize troops and forces to go there, nobody was really willing to send them. So I think the problem is actually, are you actually willing to do this kind of thing much more than the problem? I think the cases where you actually, where you don't get consent are extremely small. And probably those are cases where you shouldn't intervene, except in very, very exceptional cases. I was telling others that, you know, in my class, when the earthquake happened in Burma, you remember that the military government took a very, very long time to react and to help the victims of the earthquake. And so we had, I don't know if you were in that class, Ashley, we had a big discussion, is this a situation where responsibility to protect applies? Should we actually, from the outside, intervene to save these people because their government is not providing the emergency forces? But, of course, that's a situation where there would never have been consent, and probably the attempt to intervene without consent would have caused more humanitarian problems than it would have solved. So, anyway, I hope that is at least partly an answer to your questions. And I'm sorry that we talked so long and so there wasn't enough time for questions.
Just very quickly, I was glad to see Jennifer Cook here because I thought if I got a really tough Africa question, I was just going to throw it over to her and she could answer it. But one of the things, Jennifer, I'll touch on is, you know, once that we're in those areas, and let's take Monica, and you, both of us have seen the largest UN deployment of peacekeepers in the world. The question that I always have is, you know, what is the value added there? And a lot of times what I saw on the ground was you're looking at a tactical level. They're trained for a tactical level security. In other words, just keeping warring parties apart. And so many times with the violence or the crimes against the populations, rapes and things like that, they wouldn't even take up because they consider that a domestic issue. So, you know, how are they being trained and what is the value added for that amount of money that's going in? And I think, again, shifting that language and discussing that in terms more of the human-based security rather than a tactical breaking apart of sides and just assuming that security is going to ensue from having those parties, rival parties, broken apart, I think that's very important.
So we're going to wrap things up to get it close to the end of the time period initially. Bob, I think you have a few things you'd like to say.
Thank you both so much. Ashley will actually wrap things up, but she asked me if I would just say a few words in closing. I think if you ask most Americans what they really cared about in places like Afghanistan or Iraq or Angola, is that they don't want to be attacked. They want to be able to go to work and send their kids to school and come up with an overall life project that they find satisfying without fear that they're going to be attacked. And I think if you were to ask people in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Angola what they want from the world, is that they would probably say that they don't want to be attacked. They want to be able to go to work and send their kids to school and come up with satisfying life projects without being afraid of being attacked. And I don't think that in principle these two sets of desires are incompatible. The big challenge is, one, there are people in our society and in those societies who don't agree that those two sets of principles are incompatible. They think that they're fundamentally incompatible. That's one big challenge to overcome. Two is the more practical challenge of in a world of limited resources and limited patience and limited institutional capacities within our own societies, prioritizing effort in any particular place is a big challenge, even in things as simple as counterinsurgency. And so moving to a human security paradigm, which... You know, I think that as a lot of the questions came up today, and a lot of what you both have even written in your book is that, you know, this is the next phase of really looking at in particular places, in particular cases, in particular institutions. How do we put this into practice? And so I think your book has been a great start, and I think this event has been really interesting. So thanks.
Thanks, Bob. I'd like to second that. I think that this event is a first level of conversation to get the ball rolling, and I look forward to you guys returning to Washington and see how this concept unfolds. So thank you all for attending. Thank you to the authors for coming today. And thank you to Bob for being Bob.